end now. In a moment, should the elderly have to spend the money they've invested in their homes before they can get Medicaid to help pay for nursing home care? We'll have two opinions, but first. According to a newly declassified portion of the 9/11 Commission report, the possibility of airline hijackings and suicide missions, some of them specifically naming Osama bin Laden, were part of intelligence reports sent to federal aviation officials in the months leading up to September 11th. Further, the FAA was lulled into a false sense of security and failed to take domestic security measures such as strengthening airline screening procedures and upping the number of air marshals on flights. Eric Lischblau writes about the newly disclosed report in today's New York Times. And Eric, can you start by telling us, how does this report differ from everything we've already heard from the 9/11 Commission, much of it already scathing?
Well, this goes beyond what we've seen previously from the 9/11 Commission in a lot of ways, particularly in the criticism leveled at the FAA and its senior leadership over the failure to heed the warnings in the months leading up to 9/11. We've had the general framework before, but this lays out a lot of new detail as far as all the intelligence information that was reviewed by senior FAA officials, some of which was actually passed on to airlines and airports about the threat of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden specifically, the possibility of suicide missions, the possibility of hijackings. The conclusions of the commission were that that FAA officials believed erroneously that the threat was mostly overseas, even though there was ample evidence that there was reason to be concerned about a domestic strike.
What is some of the wording, if you can recall it?
Well, for instance, in one briefing that the FAA gave in the spring of 2001 for airport security officials, they warned about the possibility that terrorists might not simply want to hijack a plane and land it safely, as was sort of the prevailing wisdom, but to actually crash it in a spectacular explosion. So they really kind of previewed in some ways what happened on 9/11. They were aware of that possibility.
How does this square with comments from administration officials, including Condoleezza Rice, that the administration could have had no idea that someone was going to crash planes into buildings?
Well, the commission found that the FAA did not have specific information about methods and means of attack. There was nothing to suggest that they knew of a specific plot in the works. So I think that's the distinction between what Rice and others have said and what the commission has criticized the FAA and others for failing to do. There was a general awareness of Al-Qaeda and bin Laden's interest and desire to strike at the U.S., possibly to use planes, possibly to use suicide missions. There was no specific information about Mohammed Atta or the others who were planning specific plots.
What's the status of these reports, these papers that you're writing about? Where are they now? And was this information redacted, blocked out? Is it now public? What tell us more about that?
The administration gave these reports in two forms to the National Archives 2 weeks ago. One was in a classified form. The other was declassified. The declassified version has a bunch of redactions, blacked out portions about the specific language that the FAA used in its circulars and warning airports and airline officials. Many of the 9/11 commissioners I talked to were upset at these redactions because they believe this information should be out in public view and that this is no longer sensitive national security information. So there's been a running dialogue and debate between the administration and the 9/11 commission. The report was held out for more than 5 months. The report is actually dated August 2004, but it's only now been delivered in declassified form a few weeks ago.
And, Eric, what's the importance of the information, given that it's well known that there were security failures prior to 9/11? So how if at all, does this new information advance it?
Well, I think it's one more piece of the puzzle just in showing how stark the warnings were and how clear it was to many people in government that something was afoot. And it's one more sign, and in some ways the most telling sign of those missed opportunities to in some way have changed or prevented 9/11.
Eric Lischblau, reporter for the New York Times, talking about information that's newly declassified from the 9/11 Commission report. Eric, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And now to Medicaid. When budget forecasters look into the future, they see three social programs in need of attention. Social Security and Medicare are two of the so-called budget busters. Medicaid is the third. Medicaid is the state and federal program designed to provide health care for the poor and disabled. And in fact, three-quarters of recipients are children and poor adults. But a full quarter are the elderly. And this is the part of Medicaid we're going to be looking at today. Those who want to reform Medicaid say the government needs to tap into the enormous reservoir of money that the elderly have invested in their homes to help pay for their long-term care. In a moment, we're going to hear from an elder affairs lawyer who says that is just not the American way. But first, Jim Frogue. He's an expert on Medicaid for the American Legislative Exchange Council in Washington, D.C. Jim, American Legislative Exchange Council representing state legislatures?
State legislators. We have 2,400 state legislator members across the country.
Mm-hmm. And this is a huge concern for the states because?
It's a very big concern for the states because Medicaid costs are beginning to gobble up. Medicaid costs in general now cost more than K-12 education, and Medicaid is growing very rapidly and starting to crowd out every other spending priority in the states.
And you and other critics of Medicaid say there's been a perversion of what was the original intent.
Well, I think what's happening is there's been too much misuse of the dollars. Medicaid must be focused on its mission, which is to provide health care for the truly poor and indigent. What it's been doing, the way the match is structured, states are very often able to game the way the federal government gives them money and spend the dollars in ways that sometimes aren't even health care related. And the other is sometimes it's possible for seniors with creative lawyers to hide their assets and income in order to use Medicaid for their nursing home costs. And when you have providers rapidly pulling out of the system, and especially from underserved areas already, it's important to relook at what the original mission of Medicaid is supposed to be.
Right. In a moment, we're going to talk to an elder affairs lawyer who says that kind of scamming doesn't happen that often, and these are the elderly who really don't have a lot of assets. But to your concerns first, and to President Bush's budget, which came out this week, it calls for reforms to the Medicaid program that would slow the rate of spending you've been talking about. Can you first explain what the White House is proposing?
Well, the president's budget does a few things, but among one of the things that it does is it cuts down or requires more scrutiny on how states spend their Medicaid dollars to ensure that dollars actually go to low-income people and aren't misused by states for programs other than Medicaid, which can happen.
And how would that affect the elderly in particular?
Well, the elderly in particular, there are provisions in the president's budget that talk about the transfer of asset issue, and the savings he was looking at there are really pretty minor. It was only a handful of a few billion dollars over the course of 10 years. It wasn't really very much. But it does mean that it's very important for seniors to plan ahead for their retirement, and that includes long-term care insurance. People who are privately insured, when it comes time to be in nursing homes, have better options than people who have to first rely on Medicaid. And I think that's what's most important here, is that the patients are empowered when they have private coverage and don't have to rely on Medicaid for the nursing home costs right from the get-go.
Well, let's explain how the system works now, because you've mentioned a few things, and one was transfer of assets. We know that Medicaid varies from state to state how it works, but basically when a person becomes incapacitated, can't live alone, needs nursing home care, they apply for aid. Now, at that point, there are two tests, one for their income and one for their assets. For the purposes of our discussion today, we're going to talk about assets. Most elderly don't have income. Medicaid does a three-year look back. So in other words, they look back over 3 years to see what people have done with their assets.
Mm-hmm.
There are people, elderly people, who are, if they have a home, for instance, and that's all their sweat equity, they've put all their money into that home. They are, for instance, in some cases, putting the home in the name of their children so that it will not count in any way as an asset. Is this one of your concerns?
This is one of our concerns, and the three-year look back, in our report we talk about possibly states should extend that look back period, because again, this is transferring of assets that could otherwise be used for nursing home care, and it is important that people who can pay do pay.
Well, what are you saying then? An elderly couple who may have purchased a home in the 30s or 40s for an insignificant amount, and now that home has risen in value, all of their sweat equity went into it. They saved, they paid mortgages, they didn't spend like this generation does. Should they be penalized for that and have to pay what would have been their children's inheritance for their health care?
Or what? Or the taxpayers do it for them. And I think that's exactly the question that we have to ask. Is Medicaid inheritance insurance for the middle class and the upper class? I think that's a very fair public policy question to throw out there. I think part of this debate that's so critical is to have a very thorough discussion with as many interested parties as possible to make people aware of the cost of nursing home care over the long run and the importance of insuring people well in advance so this doesn't become something that people are suddenly surprised with when the time comes. This is a discussion that's going to take years and years or decades. And I think it's a very important one to have all parties at the table.
Well, critics say that, you know, the extremely wealthy don't need long-term care. The very poor don't have assets, and they have their long-term care paid for by Medicaid as it was planned. Why should the middle class be penalized by having to spend their savings, their inheritance, on their long-term health care?
Well, I think penalized is the wrong word because, again, we're talking about whether their assets and their income should pay for their health care or if the taxpayer should do it for them. That's the way the debate should be framed. I don't think that's being penalized at all.
And one last question. Many people say that the debate is actually being framed by the insurance industry, trying to push the elderly and others to buy very expensive long-term care insurance. Your thoughts on that?
Well, long-term care insurance is not expensive if you buy it young. If you buy it in your 30s and 40s, it's a few hundred dollars a year at most. And to protect the value of your home, which could run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, it's a very worthwhile investment.
When it comes right down to it, do you think that this is put before the voters who have parents that they're considering having to send to nursing homes? Do you think that this would be a popular idea to have the elderly use their assets from, let's say, the sale of a home to pay for their long-term care?
I think it would probably be something that's worthy of debate. I can't imagine it would be very popular because it can potentially affect many, many middle-class people who do vote. But again, it's important to frame the public policy debate appropriately. Is Medicaid inheritance insurance for the rich? And that's something that we just have to have a very thorough discussion about with all parties at the table.
Jim Frogue is an expert on Medicaid for the American Legislative Exchange Council in Washington, D.C., which represents state legislators. Jim, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, coming up, another opinion on Medicaid from an elder affairs lawyer who says members of the greatest generation should not be punished for saving and buying homes when the time comes to go into a nursing home. And he has another solution for funding Medicaid. And later, what about 20-somethings? Will they be able to save and invest in their future through the president's plan for privatizing Social Security? Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation about Medicaid. Now, as we just heard, critics say it's being abused by wealthy and middle-class senior citizens who hide or transfer their assets, including homes, and then ask the government to pay for nursing home care. Harry Margolis is an elder affairs lawyer at the Boston firm Margolis & Associates. He has a different opinion. And Harry, let's first of all check some of the things we just heard. First of all, and mindful that Medicaid does vary from state to state, is an elderly person's home exempt from being counted as assets, as Jim Frogue, who represents the state legislators, just said?
The way it works is they don't get you coming, they get you going. You can keep your home, you can get Medicaid, but at your death, the state has a claim to recover whatever it's paid for your care.
And that care could go on for years. And for people who are not familiar with this, it could cost, what, $80,000 to $100,000 a year?
Easily $100,000 a year in the Boston area.
So it's not true that your home is exempt.
It's exempt for eligibility purposes, but they can place a lien on it to recover their costs if you sell it or at your death.
But how about this criticism of the transfer of assets? Right now, Medicaid has a 3-year look back, meaning that they look at your assets 3 years back, and so there is criticism that many of these savvy elderly are transferring their assets to children 3 years ahead of their need and, in essence, hiding their assets and scamming the system?
Most people aren't doing that. What happens more often is that once someone enters a nursing home, then they transfer assets. And the way it works is usually you can transfer about half of your assets and keep the other half to pay for your care during a penalty period.
Legally. Well, so now some critics are saying, why should the taxpayer foot the bill at all for the elderly who have assets? Let's say a home that's worth $500,000. Why should the elderly be able to keep any of their assets if they're going to be asking the government to pay for long-term care?
I guess I have two responses to that. First, one response is, why not?
Younger taxpayers would say, I'm still trying to buy my home. If you've got that money, there are poor people who don't have any money. You shouldn't be on the same scale.
Well, I would agree entirely that it's unfortunate that the Medicaid program, which started out a safety net program for health care, is what's also being used for the middle class for long-term care. I think there should be a different program. This is really social insurance. I mean, we pay Medicare for health care. Medicare is now covering drugs. We have Social Security benefits for people because we feel those are things that taxpayers should pay for everybody. And you shouldn't just be penalized if you are unlucky enough to have Alzheimer's or some other illness that results in you needing long-term care.
Let's explain that, because Medicare does cover a lot of physical illness of the elderly and does not question their assets at all, whereas those who end up in a nursing home, and check my thinking on this, are often disabled by dementia, Alzheimer's, and that is not covered.
Exactly.
By Medicare.
And that's often misunderstood.
So if you're unfortunate enough to have, let's say, dementia as opposed to breaking your hip, you're out of luck. You have to pretty much spend down your assets in order to get long-term aid.
Right.
Unless you're covered by insurance, as you mentioned. And is that a solution, given that so many of the elderly are dropped from the insurance rolls?
Well, it's a solution if you're in your 30s and 40s. But what we're talking about here is people in their 70s and 80s. And for people who are in their 70s and 80s, it's very expensive. And most of them are uninsurable.
And I want to be clear about something. Again, critics are arguing that the elderly who are applying for Medicaid have a deep reservoir of money invested in their homes, and that should be tapped to pay for their care. In many states, here in Massachusetts, for instance, it's at least partly tapped, isn't it?
Well, it may and may not be, and it's all very case-specific. Massachusetts is interesting because I told you that they don't get you coming, they get you going, with estate recovery, but estate recovery is only against what's called probate property, property that's in your own name. So if it's in joint names or in a life estate or in a trust, and those are things we often advise clients to do to protect a home, there's no claim.
So that if you have, let's say, a home jointly with a spouse, or if you have signed a home over to your children and you go into a nursing home and sadly you pass after 5 years and it's cost the state $500,000, they cannot recover that cost from a home that you've transferred to a child 3 years earlier. But they can recover it from your home if it's still in your name.
Right.
Yeah.
And they can't recover it if it's in joint names with the child, when there's a lot of reasons not to give a home away to children, because if you do give your house away while you're healthy, there's some tax disadvantages for the children and perhaps some tax disadvantages for yourself. In addition, you're at risk because children can get divorced, they can go bankrupt, or they can disagree with you when it's time to go to a nursing home.
Yeah.
So we generally counsel clients not to give away their homes.
Harry Margolis, these are very complicated business and financial questions, but at heart, these are very emotional questions. There are those saying, why should I pay for the elderly's health care out of my tax money? They should pay for it out of their home equity. And there are those saying, why should the elderly, the greatest generation that has, you know, perhaps only their only savings are in their home, pay for their health care? Isn't that a major part of it, that it's a heartfelt question as well?
It is. I mean, I understand the problem for the state legislators in dealing with their budgets and the growth of Medicaid, but I don't think the solution is to try to save money on the backs of seniors.
What is a solution?
But it really should be covered by Medicare. If you need long-term care, the state should pay for the basic care if you want something fancier.
But that system isn't doing too well either.
Well, then maybe we need to raise some taxes. the Bush administration wants to eliminate the estate tax on the wealthy, well, maybe we should keep that estate tax and use it to pay for long-term care.
The estate tax on the wealthy would be on estates that are over a certain number of $1 million that are left to heirs. That money would be taxed.
Right. Currently, the limit is $1.5 million, so you're only taxed if your estate is larger than that. And the Bush administration wants to eliminate it completely. I agree with Mr. Frog, there should be a public debate, but I don't agree with his framing. His framing of it was that Medicaid is not inheritance insurance for the very rich. For the very rich don't get Medicaid. So the question really is, do we not make it possible for people to qualify for Medicaid who are middle income because we want to save tax money for people who are wealthy? And I think that's the public debate, and that's how I would frame it.
Harry Margolis is an elderly law attorney in Boston. Harry, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin.
And what do you think about the elderly, home equity, and Medicaid? Send us an email, here-now.org, here-now.org. Stay there. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And President Bush often speaks of young Americans when he touts his plan to reform Social Security. Remember, his plan would create voluntary personal Social Security accounts, and instead of all of their taxes going to the Social Security system, Americans might make the choice of where at least a portion of their money would be invested. But how savvy are today's 20-somethings? Are they up to the task of managing their own money? Here Now's Athena Desai offers just one reality check.
I admit, it's a bit of a personal journey of discovery. I'm 1 year south of 30, and only in the past year have I begun to grasp why one should buy instead of rent or start contributing to one's 401k. So at this point, anyone is more savvy with their funds than I am. I'm sipping chai dotted with nutmeg and chocolate powder at a coffee shop called Espresso Royale in downtown Boston. A young man of 28 approaches, in tortoiseshell glasses and a respectable cotton sweater.
My name is Peter Herman. I currently work at the New England School of Art and Design at Suffolk University. I've recently moved out to Worcester, Massachusetts from Jamaica Plain with my wife.
In his move to the less expensive city of Worcester, they managed to cut $500 in housing costs each month and buy a two-bedroom condo.
All of that on roughly $40 a year between my salary, some loan money for her, and some inheritance from my grandfather. So we do what we can to make ends meet. But, you know, her tuition is about $5,000 a year more than our gross income.
His wife is in veterinary school, so right now they're not able to put away much of anything. I asked him where he learned about handling finances.
My parents were very good, actually, about putting money away. My father passed away when I was 14. I'm the second of four. By the time he passed away, they had put away enough money that all four of us didn't have to worry about college expenses. He was working as a radiologist in a small city in eastern Pennsylvania, and we sort of lived under our means, and they put away everything extra. I think for them, that came from being in the first generation of either of their families to go to college. So neither one of them had a whole lot of money laying around growing up. I think that gave them a real appreciation for what money could do for you if you were smart about it. And I'd like to say that that advice really took hold, but I understand it more in an abstract sense than in a concrete and practical sense. I am definitely given to spending unwisely, to spending on hobbies before the mortgage is paid, to spending on meals out rather than spending on groceries. I'm aware of the things that I should be doing, but boy, it's real hard to spend wisely when you've got all the shiny stuff out there that you'd rather have.
I asked Peter how much time he spends managing his money. He says as much time as it takes to ask his wife to balance the checkbook. Choosing stocks in his 401k?
I chose once 2 years ago, and I haven't changed it since then. I had a setup meeting, and I don't know, they had some sort of stock profiles. I guess I picked the one in the middle of the road. But I'm pretty hands-off about that stuff now. It's there. It's being automatically deducted from my paycheck, and there's a match from my employer. And then I just kind of let it run.
Terrence O'Dean is an expert in investor behavior and teaches at Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley. He wrote an article saying that empowering people to make their own investment decisions could result in catastrophe. That idea comes in some part from his research. He's looked at workers in other countries who've already had a chance to control some of their retirement wealth. The evidence, he says, is discouraging.
I think often younger people may end up making hastier decisions just because lack of time, they're busy doing a lot of things. And also, if you've got less experience in making a certain type of decision, there's a tendency to go with whatever the default options are. So we find that when people invest in their 401k plans, for example, first of all, many people don't sign up for those plans as soon as they can, and sometimes they wait a couple of years before signing up and lose significant opportunity to save. When they do sign up to save, often they sign up at a lower savings rate than any financial advisors would suggest, and actually even at lower savings rates than they themselves assess as appropriate when surveyed.
In between customer requests for Italian ices and mochaccinos, I ask the guys behind the counter about their stories.
My name is Corey.
He's just graduated from college.
Currently, I save no money.
Corey's only pulling in about $20,000 a year and lists his spending priorities as food, rent, and musical recordings. Corey has faith that with age and a more lucrative job, he'll learn more about money management strategies. He says instinctually he likes the idea of having more control over his money, but he's not sure he knows enough about the president's plan to make that call.
There are factors in the world that I don't have a good understanding about. There are plenty of other ways to exert your own financial independence, and that Social Security is something that which is going to, you know, be able to help all Americans, hopefully, who, you know, have put money into it, and that everyone should be entitled to that.
Corey suggests I speak to the store manager named Will. He's 23, also a college graduate. His sandy mustache is narrow, but for some reason it makes me think of Custer at the Battle of Little Bighorn. He says somehow he manages to save about $200 to $300 a month.
And is that just like in a savings account, or is that a 401k or anything like that?
I've got some sort of Roth IRA thing going.
You believe, but you're not sure?
Yes.
How is that?
It's something that my parents have had set up, and now I have control of it. But they've tried to explain to me what it actually is. I don't quite understand money, so I just put the money in. I don't really know what it does there. My dad retired when he was 40, so I plan on doing something like that.
So when you hear the word retirement, you think...
Soon.
Wow, that's ambitious.
I ask him if he wants more ownership of his money, his investments. He guesses most young people would be like him and would rather have someone else manage it for them.
Money is just far too stressful.
In President Bush's State of the Union address, he said it is time to extend security and choice and ownership to young Americans. Berkeley professor Terrence O'Dean likens it to an airplane pilot handing passengers a short instruction manual and asking them to fly the plane. One could argue that the markets and financial investments aren't quite as complicated as flying a plane. O'Dean says you can make significant mistakes with your money when you're young. He has some reassuring words for the guys at the coffee shop. O'Dean says they're not really the ones at risk when it comes to privatizing Social Security.
They may place some undiversified bets that end up costing them and incurring some losses for them. But they're educated. Social Security for them might be a supplement. It's not the thing that they're counting on. I think the people who are greater risk are the millions of Americans who are truly counting on Social Security for their retirement wealth, people who didn't watch their parents make investment decisions, don't have as many friends who have investment expertise, basically people who don't have exposure to the markets and yet are going to have to make critical decisions.
And that report from Here and Now's 30-something-ish, Athena Desai. Well, still to come, some of the Pullman porters who rode the rails and helped drive the civil rights movement. You're listening to Here and Now. Deep Throat was the anonymous source who helped journalist Bob Woodward crack open the Watergate scandal. Deep Throat's identity has remained American journalism's closest guarded secret, and Woodward has sworn he'd keep it that way until his source dies or agrees to reveal his identity. Well, that may be soon. Former Nixon staffer John Dean hints in the Los Angeles Times this week that Deep Throat is ill, maybe dying, and that post-editor Ben Bradley has already written the obituary. But for now, scholars and the curious will have to be satisfied with studying the investigation. A new display at the University of Texas contains thousands of previously unreleased pages of Woodward and Carl Bernstein's interview notes, tapes, and other materials. And joining us on the line from the Ransom Center at the University of Texas is Tom Staley, the director. And Tom, there's been a movie, a book. What new information can researchers find in these files?
Some of the things that are going to be of great interest, for example, this will be the first time they've seen the interviews with Barry Goldwater, for example, his famous visit to Nixon when he said, "You really should resign, Mr. President." And Woodward and Bernstein visited him in his apartment and talked to him about all of these things, and they're very revealing. There are large numbers of documents that take into account this whole process that Woodward and Bernstein went through. Mm. There are the notes, the interviews, the drafts, the clippings, the correspondence, as well as images that document Woodward and Bernstein's reporting for the Washington Post, as well, of course, as their books, All the President's Men and the Final Days. There's also a stack of loose leaves torn out of a small notebook, and I think these are wonderful, on which Woodward hurriedly scrawled notes during the arraignment of the men suspected of breaking into the DNC headquarters. If you recall, he just couldn't believe it. There are also marvelous directions that Woodward gave to Robert Redford, who was playing him in the film. And these notes are the first, are very good. The earlier notes are obviously more important because they are the first that Woodward recorded on the scandal. And the notes, as it were, they're what started it all.
We're hearing that these papers also reveal how, in his zeal to cover this up, that many of the people around him started to think that Richard Nixon was not all that well psychologically.
That is true. The thing that happened, why were Woodward and Bernstein there, these two cub reporters? Remember, it happened on a weekend. That's where cub reporters were the lowest on the totem pole, did the weekend duty, and then they would get calls from a plant at City Hall and say, "Hey, look, there might have been a burglary." They go and look into it, and of course, they don't know it. Then on Monday morning, usually the senior reporters come in and say, "Hey, yeah, we'll take this over." And of course, the young reporters said, "Hey, well, wait, our sources are such that they won't talk to anyone else."
Right.
So that's how they got onto the story.
Tom Staley, as you're surrounded by all this research, do you find yourself wondering who Deep Throat is?
Well, those papers, the agreement that we have with Woodward and Bernstein, the university made, was because of the integrity of the two young reporters, they said they would never reveal their sources until their death. That was the agreement. And obviously, we don't have those papers until such time as Deep Throat dies.
Are they hidden away?
They're in a safe place, not at the Ransom Center, which is where the papers are at the University of Texas at Austin. There are trustees who are looking at this and keeping it in a perfectly clear legal way.
Mm-hmm. Tom Staley, as you're surrounded by all this research, do you find yourself wondering who Deep Throat is?
I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint your audience. Why we got this archive at the university was because of its research value. I think that this is a fascinating and seminal event in American history. It's raised an incredible array of issues that will continue to resonate with us for years to come. I think it's a great resource for students. Those students in journalism that want to talk about First Amendment rights, the whole issue of the First Amendment, the issue of the presidency, the division of powers, these are the issues that really, I think, are far more interest to me than that I'm curious about Deep Throat like everyone else, but I'm more interested that this is an archive which is a springboard for interdisciplinary research and study.
Tom Staley is director of the Ransom Center at the University of Texas, where a new exhibit of Woodward and Bernstein's Watergate research has just opened. For more, you can visit our website at here-now.org. And Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Updating some of today's top news stories, North Korea is for the first time publicly admitting that it has nuclear weapons. Officials in the communist state say the bombs are protection against an increasingly hostile United States. But speaking in Luxembourg today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said North Korea has nothing to fear.
The United States has no intention to attack or invade North Korea. The North Koreans have been told that they can have security assurances on a multilateral basis if they are prepared to take a definitive decision to dismantle their nuclear weapons programs and to do so in a way that is verifiable.
Secretary Rice urged North Korea to return to six-nation disarmament talks. A fourth round of talks was canceled back in September when North Korea refused to attend. Meanwhile, wedding bells will toll on April 8th in Great Britain. Prince Charles announced today that he will marry his longtime lover, Camilla Parker Bowles. His sons, William and Harry, were reported to be delighted with the news, and Prime Minister Tony Blair also sent his best wishes.
I'm delighted for the Prince of Wales and Camilla Parker Bowles. It's very happy news, and when the Cabinet heard it this morning, they sent congratulations and good wishes on behalf of the whole government. We all wish them every happiness for their future together.
The British public has never really warmed to Camilla Parker Bowles. Some of us have not gotten her name right. And they often compared her unfavorably to Princess Diana, whom Prince Charles divorced a year before she was killed in a car crash. Camilla is also divorced, and the Church of England, the legally established faith of the nation, disapproves of the remarriage of divorced people in church. So the couple will marry in a civil ceremony. As for Camilla's title, she will use Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Cornwall. And when Charles becomes king, she will be referred to as the princess consort, not queen. There are very few Pullman porters still alive, but there used to be thousands of them. African-American men who worked on George Pullman's railroad cars, who unknowingly became unsung heroes in the fight for civil rights. Gerard Smock Jr. was a Pullman porter. He died Saturday at the age of 86 in Los Angeles, and while his name is unfamiliar to most of us, a picture of him in uniform became the cover of the book Rising from the Rails, The Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. Here now, producer April Peavy attended a book launch party at Railway Station last year, where she caught up with a few retired Pullman porters and author Larry Tye.
During this era, and I'm talking about the whole era from the end of the Civil War on for 100 years, it was very unusual for a black man to do several things that Pullman porters were able to do. It was very unusual for them to be able to travel the country and see anything outside of their local community. It was very unusual for them to have money in their pocket and to have enough to earn a decent living. And the Pullman porters, over those years, observed the lessons that they learned from their wealthy white passengers, everything from financial lessons to the importance of education to a sense that America and the American experience was something that they could grab onto. And this was the ultimate all-American success story.
My name is Otis A. Gates. I was a Pullman porter. I made bed, waited on people, rich and poor. Put them to bed, wake them up. And I used to haul a lot of school children. lot of 14 or 15 girls going to college at night. When the boys come up, I say, uh-oh.
At what age were you a Pullman porter?
Oh, I started when I was about 15 or 18 years old. For 52 years on it.
For 52 years?
That's my age. Yeah, I love my job, I did. I liked it. I put a lot of time in. I couldn't do it no more, though.
My name is Ellen Martin Story, and my father was a Pullman porter for about 15 years, from the late 19-teens through the 30s. My grandfather, he was a Pullman porter his whole career, and he built his own house. So for an African-American family to have a house that was built, that my father grew up in, and his brothers and sisters, back in the early 1900s, was incredible. I mean, African-American families didn't have that, but they had that. They had a car. My dad had one of the first TVs because they had been Pullman porters and they had that steady income.
What is it like to see your dad's story now in print?
It's emotional.
Is your dad still around?
No, my dad passed away a month after Larry interviewed him. So my dad would have been so happy at this. He really would have. He would have thought, this is just the greatest thing.
They say that the civil rights movement was born in Montgomery, Alabama, with the Montgomery bus boycott. The first person that Rosa Parks talked to after she was arrested, and the guy who came and bailed her out, was Edgar Nixon, a Pullman porter. He was the brains behind the Montgomery bus boycott, only he was too busy traveling the country by train to run the boycott himself. So excuse my expression, but he took this young, naive minister named Martin Luther King Jr., who happened to have the biggest church in town, and he decided this will be the front guy who will get this boycott going. But behind the scenes, it was a Pullman porter who was pulling the strings. Malcolm X was a railroad porter. He wasn't with the Pullman Company, but he was part of that same generation. And Malcolm X said that he learned how human relations worked more by watching what went on in the closed capsule of the railroad car than in anything he ever learned later in the civil rights movement. And he was quite extraordinary in translating his experiences from the railroad car into his experiences with America. If you look at prominent African Americans today, be they in law and science, in politics, or in any field that you can name, there's an extraordinary and a disproportionate percent of them who were the children and grandchildren, the nieces and nephews of Pullman porters and of dining car guys like George Johnson.
My name is George E. Johnson, and I was a dining car waiter and a waiter in charge who's similar to a head waiter in a restaurant or a hotel.
When were you on the trains, working on the trains?
I went to work for them in 1940 and retired in 1971.
What did your job entail?
Well, we had dining cars in those days, full dining cars, and people came in from various parts of the train to come in to eat. It was my job at that point. When I first went on, I had all I was doing was serving, because we had a porter, a steward. The stewards were all white, and the rest of the help was all black at that time. And I served people. And, of course, the more money you made depended upon your service and your affability. That's where you made your money.
What I'm trying to do in this book is say, behind that experience of that incredible service in their being very obliging, they were wearing a mask, and they had to endure extraordinary humiliation, and it's the kind of experience that porters very seldom talked about. And I'm trying to say, yes, there was an era of romance, but when we look beyond the romance, the real romance of their stories is that they survived and they went on to produce so many people who are making contributions to America, and we ought to understand what they went through in doing that.
Larry Tai is author of Rising from the Rails, The Pullman Porters, and the Making of the Black Middle Class. Our visit was produced by April Peavy. And Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now. Thank you. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Rob.